Wilshire rips it home.
Jonathan Toews lights the lamp.
Holy cheese and crackers.
On back-to-back shots, the Jets have their first lead of the night.
Such a fine line in the National Hockey League, winning and losing. It's scary. You're only as good as the group.
Jets have won their 16th game of the year.
The big plays, the big stories, the biggest news from across the hockey landscape. This is NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things NHL. TSN 1290.
TSN1290.ca.
Welcome to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve, filling in the host chair for the next four shows. I'm Richard Pollack. Drew Mandel is away on his honeymoon. I'm joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg, Dave Manuk of IllegalCurve.com, and Michael Remus on loan from Rick Ralph and the Rona Roundtable. And guys, before we even get into the main issues of the week, before we even preview the guests of today's show, there's much to talk about, by the way. We're going down the stretch here. Michael Remus has already got beef with Shane Knighty.
What, you want me to talk about this?
Yeah, I want to hear about it.
We were supposed to call him at 12:15. I called him at 12:20. He was in the dressing room doing interviews, and he wasn't happy that we were late.
Is this the second mishap, though?
We had him on Friday, and we had a bit of a mishap there. He kind of got bumped.
I can attest, Shane wasn't happy with Remo.
That's, of course, David Manuk of IllegalCurve.com. Ezzy?
Well, Reem, you know, Knighty is a huge fan of yours.
You sure about that?
And you better be careful, because we've had him on this show before, and he said, you know, he really likes you, except for the way you wear your hat. So you better be careful, because you might lose your number one fan. But I'm sure you'll settle your beef either off-air or on-air.
Got a lot to talk about today, guys. NHL GM meetings are, of course, underway, and you heard Darren Dreger on HNL just a couple minutes ago. Corey Perry re-upped this week with the Anaheim Ducks. We are going to speak to Dan Wood of the Anaheim Ducks radio broadcast next segment. He's going to talk about Getzlaff re-signing and Corey Perry re-signing. The last time we had Dan on was a few weeks ago. Neither of those players had signed, so it was still an issue. Later on in the show, we're going to have Jim Fox on, LA Kings color commentator for Fox Sports West. The Kings have quietly for a defending Stanley Cup champion, you know, ascended up the standings, and Drew Doughty got off the schneid. We're going to talk to him about the Kings and see, you know, which direction they're going. Among other things, we're going to talk about the trade deadline. It's upcoming, Yezzy. We're going to do six things we learned this week. Dave and Ezzy are combining on that this week because, of course, I'm sitting here in the host chair. We're going to break down the Washington Capitals penalty kill. The next 2 days are going to be fun. Capitals are in town here. They play the Jets 7 o'clock tomorrow night and then 6 o'clock Hockey Night in Canada game. That's why the 6 o'clock start on Friday night. So a rare home, not home and home, just home. Two back-to-back games, and then you're going to have Tampa Bay Lightning in town on Sunday. Guys, I want to start with the NHL GM meetings. A lot of issues were discussed. Coaches' challenges, goaltending equipment. Maybe let's start at the goaltending equipment. They want to cut down on it. They talk about the issue of scoring and the problem with everybody having to shoot high because you can't beat goalies low anymore. I mean, hasn't this issue really been discussed since the Garth Snow days of the late 90s? Nothing's ever changed.
We listened to it earlier just now on Hustler and Lawless, and they were talking about Kay Whitmore, who's now involved with bringing these types of issues to the NHL Competition Committee. And yeah, Richie, you know, you'd think that this is, first off, this isn't a major issue here as far as the GM meetings go, as far as I'm concerned. Now, as far as general managers go, they're bringing this issue up because of the fact that I think certain things have crept up and they're starting to see some inconsistencies. But this was dealt with almost 10 years ago now, before the last lockout, and you'd have to think that if it's a question of a couple of centimeters, you know, at the top of the goalie pad, then that's something that can easily be solved, and this shouldn't be something that carries on for too long.
But unfortunately, it feels like this has never ended. Like, as just alluded to, I mean, we have been hearing about this adjustment for pads for how long now, and it still hasn't gotten done. And there really is no reason. I mean, there's a competition committee. They can evaluate whether this needs to be done, how it can be done properly, how you can, implement it so it doesn't make a huge adjustment to the game. But obviously they want to do that because they want to increase scoring. And so that's if that's the objective, then do it. But stop talking about it. I mean, it's taken forever already.
I agree. And I think my take on this is, they talk about, protecting the goalies. Well, then if you're really that worried about it, take away the one-piece sticks, which speed up the shots. Go back to the wooden sticks, which improve handling the puck, allegedly. And then what you have is, and you take down some of the equipment, and then you don't have that safety issue as much, and maybe you do increase goaltending, you do increase scoring. I think at the end of the day, you still are getting back to the issue of scoring, and these ways to try and increase scoring in the NHL is having a lot of trouble doing that.
Richie, you just mentioned it, though. If you're trying to increase scoring, okay, and I don't know how you would possibly quantify this in a study, but how does removing a few centimeters off the top or the inside of the pad, how does that directly correlate into increased scoring versus getting the trapezoid rule out, who, as you know, Marty Brodeur was the one that they basically created that rule because Marty Brodeur was so good at handling the puck. You could directly probably say, also difficult to quantify, but the point being that you could easily correlate that to an increase in scoring because of the fact that the goaltender would be able to play the puck, and it increases more offensive play, whereas opposed to the goaltending equipment, which kind of seems like, to be honest with you, a little bit of a kind of a minor detail and something that, to be honest with you, I never think about on a daily basis.
No, I don't think so either. And again, you know, it's not difficult to see what kind of impact you can do this. You implement it in the lower leagues, and you see what kind of effect it has. And then you'll see. Okay, so we're not saying you have to do this next year in the NHL. But, maybe you implement it into the AHL. And then and then from there, you'll see, oh, wow, what kind of impact did that have?
I hope, Richie, by the way, I know we're going to get to the other other issues of the day. I hope they didn't spend more than 20 minutes on this, maybe, or even 5 minutes on this, when we have the visor issue out there.
You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve, joined in studio by David Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg, and Michael Remus, opping and producing as he always does on loan, of course, from Rick Ralph and the Rona Roundtable. Guys, they talked about, or they didn't really talk about, stage fighting. It's interesting what gets priority and what doesn't get priority here. As Matthew Schneider said, he said the issue of stage fighting, and it didn't really come up. There's a kind of a player simulation, but that was only briefly discussed as per TSN.ca. Do you ever see that? Well, not ever, but do you see that changing in the near future, the idea of the stage fight? And I guess the question really there is, how do you define what a stage fight is?
If two guys drop their gloves at the beginning of a game, is that a stage fight? How do you define it? If they're talking about it on the ice, is that a stage fight? So I think there is a gray area there, Richie. I've said this time and time again, as you guys know on the show, I'm a fan of fighting and I'm old school when it comes to fighting. I think it does have a place in the game. A lot of people out there will agree with me. A lot of people will disagree. It's one of those polarizing things. But as far as stage fighting goes, I do agree that that should be taken out. I don't think that WWE element should be in hockey, but I think it's going to be very difficult to enforce. And like you said, it hasn't been brought up yet, but you have to think that if they are going to bring this up, it shouldn't just be as a bullet point on the agenda of the GM's meetings. It should be something that's addressed because, as we know, the Fraser McLaren fight with Dave Drusinski, when he went down with that injury, people were complaining that that was a stage fight and it had no purpose. And quite frankly, they might have been right about that.
I just don't think you're going to be able to get rid of stage fighting unless the GM start and signing players and the coaches start employing players who really provide one dimension, that's fighting. If you can play like Sean Thornton last night, for example, in the Jets versus Bruins game, he had points where he was handling the puck, he was skating out there. He wasn't just a one-dimensional player. Visors is an issue, guys. We know that. It's become more of an issue lately with the Mark Stahl injury. Nothing was decided today, but there was talk that maybe there will be a vote by the PA, as there was in 2009, although that was voted down, in terms of grandfathering in visors. We know the NHL is for it for a variety of reasons, protecting their assets, if you want to refer to the players as assets, and as one of them. Do you guys think this issue will get more traction as the next 6, 7, 8 months go on?
I can't see how it won't. And the problem, the thing I don't understand in terms of implementation is you already have it mandatory in the AHL. You already have it mandatory in the junior. So these guys are already wearing visors. And the The idea is that they can't wait to rip the visor off, even though they've been probably wearing it for 4, 5, 6, 7 years.
Forever.
That's yeah, exactly, forever. And suddenly now you need to take it off because you're a professional. So, I mean, I have a bit of a problem with that because, like, why all of a sudden? I understand it's easier to see and whatnot, but the point is you've already been wearing it, you're used to wearing it, and the reality is for the players who are currently playing, it's like the helmet issue from the 80s, in the 70s and 80s, the players who are already wearing it, it didn't matter to them. And the ones who weren't wearing it, fine. They can keep the helmet off. And then, you know, you slowly but surely you lose it to the last few guys, the Rod Langways, the, you know, Randy Carlisle's, those guys. Yep. And they become dinosaurs because everybody else is wearing a helmet. Similarly, you have the visor issue and you have these guys. What's the stat? I've heard varying numbers, but I think it's 65 to 73%.
Right now, Schneider says 72 to 73% based on the NHLPA's numbers or the amount of players that wear visors in the league. So, I mean,
so
that's...
We're literally talking about a minority, 27% of players who are the ones who are holding this up. So is it really that difficult? I mean, if you've got the majority of players wearing it, why should it be difficult to implement?
Dave, the most important aspect of the 72% number is that number has gone up every single year. I mean, as recently as 6 or 7 years ago, it was 50%. So what's important about that 73% number is, yes, that, like you just said, that means that the minority of players do not wear visors now, but it also means that the trend is going towards 80% and 85%. So really, again, as we've talked about before, it's just a matter of time. And when you're talking about grandfathering visors in, if there are some players that just don't want to get rid of the visor, well, the young guys are the ones that are going to have to wear them, and they've already been wearing them.
Corey Perry wears a visor. Ryan Getzlaff doesn't.
He did for a bit.
Did for a bit, though.
Yeah.
Close players. Next, with Dan Wood of the Anaheim Ducks Radio Network, you're listening to the NHL Midweek with The Legal Curve live on TSN 1290. To the NHL Midweek. The Legal Curve, Richard Pollock filling the host chair for Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg in his usual spot, David Manuk of IllegalCurve.com in my usual spot, of course, Michael Remus, producing the show as always.
The TSN 1290 NHL Midweek Hotline.
We're joined on the line by Dan Wood, the Anaheim Ducks Radio Network. Dan joined us on February 27th and has been kind enough to join us soon after that. Dan, how are you?
I'm good, Richard. How are you?
Doing great, Dan, and appreciate you coming on tonight. Of course, is a huge matchup between the Anaheim Ducks and Chicago Blackhawks. We're not really going to focus on that within this interview, but you know that probably is the game of the night, probably the game of the week. Dan, we had you on February 27th, and since then, a lot has happened. March 8th, Ryan Getzlaff re-ups with the Ducks, and obviously huge news for the organization, 8 years and $66 million. Did that news, or maybe specifically the timing of that news, surprise you at all?
The news didn't surprise me because I think the sense here was that Ryan Getzlaff was going to re-sign with the Ducks. You know, the timing, I mean, it surprised me in the sense that it was a game day. But in this day and age, when something happens, you really can't hang on to it because it's going to break. And we saw the same thing the other night with Corey Perry with an announcement during a game. Mm-hmm. So the Getzlaff news didn't surprise me. The Perry news was very pleasant news for all of us in Anaheim because, you know, there had been a lot of conjecture that maybe Corey Perry wanted to play closer to home, closer to where he played junior in London, Ontario. And there was some concern about that here. And to get him signed on the heels of Getzlaff signed, obviously, tremendous news for the Ducks.
Dan, you mentioned that there was some conjecture leading up to the signing of Corey Perry, and you know his signing didn't come much after Ryan Getzlaff signing. How important was re-signing Ryan Getzlaff as far as it goes to the negotiations with Corey Perry?
Well, I don't imagine Corey Perry re-signs here if Ryan Getzlaff doesn't. These guys have been joined at the hip ever since they came into the NHL with the Ducks, and probably more so than any two players in the league I can think of, with the exception of the Sedins in Vancouver. You know, Getzlaff and Perry have played together forever. They've obviously had a lot of success, you know, both at the NHL level, in the Olympics with Team Canada. And, you know, they just play off each other so well. So I could have imagined Ryan Getzlaff being here and not Corey Perry, but not really the other way around. And I think when Corey looked at it after Getzlaff had signed here, he had to ask himself the question, okay, if I go elsewhere to, you know, team X, Y, or Z, who's going to be my centerman? And how much success am I going to have there? You know, there just aren't a lot of centers with the skill set that Ryan Getzlaff possesses and that fits so well with Corey Perry. So, you know, short of a Pittsburgh or a Chicago or, you know, a couple of teams here and there, I don't think Corey was going to find that, and I think he's fully aware of that.
Now, Dan, did you think or did Anaheim believe that it was going to be signed in that order?
You know, I can't speak for Bob Murray or the organization. I know that when those two signed before, when they came out of their entry-level contracts, Ryan Getzlaff signed during the season, and at that point, the Ducks were not able to sign Corey Perry because they had some tagging issues with regard to the salary cap. That was on the heels of the whole Scott Niedermeyer came with Solani sabbatical, and then you know, signing Todd Bertuzzi and Matthew Schneider, and they had to trade Andy McDonald to fit Scott Niedermeyer back in when he returned. So they had to wait until after July 1st to re-sign Corey Perry, who at that time was a restricted free agent. But, you know, the order is the same. Getzlaff first, then Perry, and it played out that way again.
We're joined by Dan Wood, radio color analyst for the Anaheim Ducks, joined Steve Carroll, of course, in the radio booth there in Anaheim, and covered the team for many years. We've had him on a guest that we had him on when he was covering the team for the Orange County Register, doing a great job there. Dan, were you surprised at all that both of these players didn't sign for the identical contracts?
Well, no, and they did last time. Basically, it was the same amount of money, although the deals were structured a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. But I think there had to be some reward for Corey Perry having won a Hart Trophy, and I think that's the only real difference in the contract. I don't know this for a fact, but I'm guessing there are some bonus clauses in there, you know, that should Ryan Getzlaff win a Hart Trophy, you know, who knows, maybe he'd make exactly the same amount as Corey Perry over the next 8 years.
Dan, how much trepidation did Bob Murray have knowing that this was going to eat up a significant amount of the salary cap next year, which, as we know, is going down?
Really, I don't think any, because the Ducks are in pretty good shape as far as the salary cap goes. You know, they don't really have any issues there. And I think when you look at it, the Ducks really didn't have any choice. I mean, you know, what options did they have? To trade one or both of these guys before the deadline, there's no way they were going to get equal value back. Or to let them walk away getting no value back if they left as free agents. You just don't find these types of players very often. And when you have them in the prime of their careers, of course it's going to be expensive. That's just the nature of the beast these days. But, you know, I think it was a no-brainer. I think the only way those guys would not have been here would have been had they chosen that route. The Ducks, I don't think it was any question that they had to do everything they possibly could to get them signed.
So was Bruce Boudreau's coaching style and the team's success a significant factor in these decisions?
Well, Bruce is a player's coach, and there's no doubt about that. I can tell you that in my conversations and what I've overheard from Getzlaff and Perry in their media scrums after having signed the deals, you know, they did not mention that. You know, they didn't specifically talk about Bruce, but you know, I have to think that they like playing for him. I mean, I don't know a player that wouldn't like playing for Bruce Boudreau and what he's done with this team since coming in last season when the Ducks were down and out, and that's putting it mildly. You know, he rescued the team last year, got it to the brink of playoff contention before they simply ran out of gas. And obviously this year the numbers speak for themselves. So, you know, I'm sure those guys don't mind playing for Bruce.
You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Legal Curve, joined on the line by Dan Wood, the radio color analyst for the Anaheim Ducks. You know, Dan, on that point, you know, theoretically speaking, and the next couple of questions are somewhat theoretical, if the Ducks are, you know, 10, 12, and 4 right now, do you think the situation turns out differently?
I think there's a good chance that it does. I think particularly for Corey Perry, see, Ryan Getzlaff, he's married to a local girl here. Mm-hmm. He's really made his home here now. And so there was less chance, I guess, you could say, that he might go elsewhere. For Corey Perry, though, I know he wanted to see whether the Ducks were going to be competitive, you know, and what the future looked like as far as that goes. And I think looking at what's happened this season, both with some of the veteran acquisitions the team has made you know, the Sheldon Surrays, the Brian Allens, the Dan Winnicks, going out and signing Victor Fast out of Sweden, and also the progress that some of the young players in the organization have made. Nick Bonino, Kyle Palmieri, Lucas Pisa, Cam Fowler, Emerson Edom, guys like that. I think Perry and Getzlaff look at it and say, you know, yeah, we can win here. Mm-hmm. And I certainly think that's a big factor. It's funny because I wondered if the Ducks had done this last year, would Justin Schultz be here now? You know?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. I mean, based on what they did in the offseason, Dan, you know, adding the size that they did, I mean, a smaller defense when it can move the puck just would have just fit in perfectly with the squad as currently configured.
Well, and the Ducks wanted Justin Schultz. I mean, they did everything they could to get him signed here, obviously. But, you know, he had his own reasons, I guess. And, you know, he's in Edmonton. For what it's worth, he's a lot farther down in the Western Conference standings.
That's a good point. And when you look at Getzlaff signing first, and another hypothetical, and then we'll get on to what's really ahead for the Ducks. Getzlaff signs, and then there's a lot of speculation about Perry, and he even says, you know, the time off from the suspension really allowed him to shed some light on what was going on with his career and where he wanted to be. Do you think that the Ducks, sitting second in the Western Conference, could arguably be the best team in the National Hockey League, would have dealt Corey Perry had they not been able to re-sign him before April 3rd?
Had they not been able to re-sign him, it's my personal opinion that you would have had to deal him, because if you weren't going to sign him before the deadline, you had to figure your chances of signing him this summer weren't very good. So you were facing the Zach Parise-Ryan Suter situation where you're going to lose a premier player and get absolutely nothing in return. Of course, it would have thrown a real monkey wrench into this season, which has been so good for the Ducks. My personal opinion is that you would have had to do it even at the expense of what it might have meant for your chances this year. Because, let's be honest, there's only one team that wins the Cup.
Right.
New Jersey got to the finals. They didn't win the Cup last season, and now they don't have Zach Parise. I don't think the Ducks wanted to go down that road. So that's my opinion, and it's one that I'm pretty confident Bob Murray shares as well. So I don't think Corey Perry would have been here on April 4th had he not re-signed.
Dan, now that Bob Murray has signed Corey Perry, he signed Ryan Getzlaff, he's got those two big contracts settled. What is next as far as needs for the Anaheim Ducks go with just a couple of weeks to go before the trade deadline?
Well, if you look at it, you know, in terms of immediacy, the one spot on this club that I think the Ducks would identify as being the place where they would like to upgrade would be a second-line center. And it's interesting because I remember last summer, or at least before the season started, Bruce Boudreau said that Saku Koivu was going to play third-line center. And I asked myself, well, who's going to play second-line center? Because they don't really have one.
Mm-hmm.
And they still don't. But they have moved Saku Koivu down to what is effectively a third line with Dan Winnick and Andrew Cogliano. And they've just kind of tried to plug that hole in the middle on the second line. You know, Nick Bonino has played there. He's hurt right now, but he's done a decent job. They've moved Bobby Ryan there at times, and obviously he's played more on the wing. You know, they've played Peter Holland there a little bit, a rookie center. But that's the one spot that they would look at and say, if we could get an established veteran guy to anchor that second line, and ideally fit with Teemu Selanne, you know, that's what they'd like to do. But then again, that's easier said than done.
Dan Wood, radio color analyst for the Anaheim Ducks, one of our favorites. Thanks very much for joining us on NHL Midweek with the Illegal
Thanks players. For having me, guys. I'll come on anytime.
Appreciate that, Dan.
You bet.
After the break, NHL trade deadline, as we mentioned, April 3rd. Coverage all day here on TSN 1290. Jerome McGinley, Dan Boyle, Marian Gaborik, only a few of the names mentioned on Insider Trading last night on TSN. We're going to discuss all of those players after the break. You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve live on TSN 1290. You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve on TSN 1290. Richard Pollock sitting in the host chair for Drew Mandel, joined in the studio by Ezra Ginsberg, David Manuk, and Michael Remus. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/illegalcurve. You can follow us on Instagram at Illegal Curve. Remus has been doing a heck of a job there with some really nice photos of the Jets and of us, if that can be considered nice. In any event, this segment's brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, conveniently located at 1700 Corden Avenue in the Corden Village Mall. Bernstein's is a family-owned and operated traditional-style deli that has been serving traditional deli food for nearly 30 years. Take it home or eat it there. Bernstein's Deli is your deli destination in South Winnipeg. Check out their website at bernsteinsdeli.com. And guys, before we get into the trade deadline stuff, Sunday, this past Sunday, was the opening, grand opening, of Bernstein's on a Sunday. Bernstein's has been open for 30 years. This was the first Sunday. Bernstein's was open. Ezzy was there. Dave was there. I was there. Remus wasn't invited.
Oh, I was sleeping for sure. There's no way I'd wake up that early.
You took a nice picture on Instagram of the omelet.
It's really nice that Bernstein's is open because it's the best place in the city for sandwiches and soups and everything. So very happy that they're sponsoring us, and it's good that they're open Sundays.
Yeah, I'll be there again this Sunday, Ezzy, if you're going to be inviting me. I'll be there anyways. Last time we were at different tables. It was kind of awkward.
It was Ezzy and I at our own private table.
Yeah.
Because we actually got there on time.
Sorry.
But it's a nice breakfast alternative.
Interesting.
You're welcome.
Okay, guys, we want to talk about the trade deadline, though. As much as I want to talk about Ezzy's consumption of corned beef. There's a number of players who are being bandied about, and big names. You know, you kind of feel like, I think the first one here would really be the Ray Bourque analogy. And that's Jerome McGinley. Jerome McGinley is on the Flames, obviously. Everybody knows that. The Flames are an organization that doesn't seem to have any direction whatsoever. Jerome McGinley has come within one game of winning the Stanley Cup against Tampa in 2004, but hasn't ever raised the cup. He's pending UFA. And there's talk now that he may be on the market. And if so, teams like Detroit, Boston, Pittsburgh, maybe L.A., are interested in his services. What do you think? How do you think it resolved itself?
Well, you mentioned that the Flames have never won the Stanley Cup, and they might not have direction right now. But the reality is that
never won with McGinley. They won in 89.
Right. Yeah. Sorry. They've never won with McGinley. Is what I meant to say. They're out of the playoff spot right now, and the key thing right here is that if they don't trade him, they might lose him for nothing again. And that's the key thing. Jerome McGinley has a no-movement clause, so he is going to choose which team he potentially goes to. And it's up in the air right now as far as what they decide to do. Now, when you're talking about Jerome McGinley, you're talking about a guy who scored 30 goals 11 or 12 times, whatever it is. And he's a future Hall of Famer. And if you decide to trade him, you could probably ask for quite a bit. Now, my personal opinion is that they should probably trade him because I don't think that this team is going to go anywhere, even if they do squeak into a 7th or 8th playoff spot. And Jerome McGinley's 35 years old, 36 years old. He's only got a few years left. And you know that he wants, at this point in his career, he's already won Olympic gold a couple times, and he's already won the Rocket Richard trophy and all that. So you have to think that, yeah, you do have a Ray Bourque situation, and that's probably what he wants is a Stanley Cup.
Sport Club Stats has the Flames' chances of making the playoffs at under 20%, 19.4%. I mean, don't you have to deal him?
I mean, the Flames are only 4 points out of the playoffs right now, but and it's hard to ever imagine the Calgary Flames without Jerome McGinley as the captain. But at the same time, you have to think if you're the Flames, first of all, the Flames need to bite the bullet that they should have bit about 3 years ago, that they need to rebuild this organization from the ground up. And that really starts by trading McGinley. I know it sounds like sacrilegious to say that.
Let me ask you this, though. Let me interrupt there for a second. Ezzy, you sign Hudler, you sign Weidman, you give out these bigger deals for longer term, and then you're going to suddenly rebuild? I mean, where's the direction? That's the problem. It seems to be the opposite of the direction that the Flames have been going, under Feaster even. So, again, that makes sense, but will it happen within the structure of that organization with the direction they're apparently taking, whatever direction that may be?
No, it won't. I mean, I'm not saying that this is what they're going to do. I'm saying this is what they should be doing.
What do you think they will do?
what I think they'll do is, well, I don't know. I honestly don't know at this point. Calgary is such a wild card.
We've been talking about this for 2 years. And I think that, you're going to get five opinions. And so I'm just going to say what I think that they should do, and I think they should have moved him last year. The Flames are the mixture of talent that they have. What's happened since Dennis Wiedemann's been a huge bust?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
they brought
huge bust. He hasn't played that poorly defensively.
Let's
be honest. That poorly just based on what they gave him. Didn't make sense.
Right. Yeah. And they've brought Roman Cervenka in. I don't see his name.
He's been a bust.
Among the top 20 scorers.
Well, the problem is you bring in Cervenka to play center, and then he comes in and says, I don't want to play center.
Exactly. So what's happened is you've spent all this money now, and you've forced yourself now to move him, and you've forced yourself to rebuild. And now, I guess the best thing is that you've got Yuri Hudler now as one of your veterans. But they're just not good enough. And you see what's happened. You know, Mikko Kiprusoff goes down, and they actually manage to stay around and play 500 hockey. But at best, the Flames, you know, sure, if you want to say that if the Flames squeak in, anything can happen. I don't think they're good enough to pull an L.A. Kings run, but that would just be someone else's opinion. But you have to deal with this situation more so that Jerome Iginla is the type of guy, he's never going to come out and say that he wants to go to another
team. Exactly right.
But, I mean, we know that he wants to go to another team.
2004, of course, Iginla loses to the Tampa Bay Lightning. And a player who is a big part of that team is Dan Boyle. Dan Boyle, obviously in San Jose right now, making $6.6 million per year. He signed for this year and for next year. Getting, obviously, up there in years, you know, late 30s now. There are rumors that the New York Rangers are interested in Dan Boyle's services. I guess the first question is, do you guys think he'll be moved? And the second question is, do you think that the Rangers are a reasonable landing spot for him?
Well, when you talk about Dan Boyle, and you know, we know how good he was in Tampa. He's been a 50-point defenseman for the San Jose Sharks. If they trade Dan Boyle, I mean, you've got Marc-Edward Vlasic, you know, anchoring your defense with Brent Burns, who right now is playing forward. I mean, Dan Boyle is your number one defenseman. So as far as trading him, that's a huge decision, and you're going to have to hope that the depth that you have in your organization is going to be able to replace that. I would argue that it wouldn't. But as far as the Rangers going after him, they were just here in Winnipeg, and we know what's happened with the Rangers without Mark Stahl. They don't look as solid. Ryan McDonough is a good defenseman. Michael Delzato is a good defenseman. Mm-hmm. Girardi, but you're talking about more defensive guys, especially when you're talking about Dan Girardi.
Yeah.
I can see why Glenn Sather and the Rangers would make a phone call about Dan Boyle. He makes a lot of money, and as you mentioned, Richie, his best offensive days are behind him. I still think he's the type of guy that can probably anchor your power play and be your top-producing defenseman. But for me, that's what I think of when you mention that. How are you going to replace Dan Boyle? Because as soon as you take Dan Boyle off of your roster, if you're the Sharks, there's a huge hole to fill there.
And that's the thing. They want Burns to eventually fill that hole, if not right away. But, you know, he hasn't really succeeded there thus far. And who knows why. You know, the Rangers obviously need to fill out the top four. But if Stahl comes back, I don't see the need for it, especially with Ryan McDonough being a RFA after this year. He's going to demand big bucks.
Yep.
The Rangers have really reasonable contracts on their back end right now. They're paying Stahl under $4 million. Girardi under $3.5 million, Delzato $2.5 million. I mean, the output for those guys when they're healthy is way better than the money that they're getting paid in relative terms, of course, in NHL. And then you got McDonough coming up. I don't know about that, but I guess that leads to the next question. And Marian Gaborik, you know, he apparently is on the market for the right deal. They're not selling. He's on the market for the right deal. Do you guys see him being the guy, kind of player who's going the other way in a deal for a big time defenseman if Stahl doesn't come back?
Well, Dave, if you're talking about moving Dan Boyle and you're talking about taking on that salary, off the top of my head, I think it's $6 million.
6.6. Yeah.
There you go. Then someone's going to have to come out. You've got Rick Nash. You've got Brad Richards. You've got Henrik Lundqvist. Those guys all make well above the average salary of the NHL.
Sure.
You're talking $5 or $6 million players. So someone's going to have to move there, Richie. And Gaborik is a pending UFA after next year,
that's right,
if I'm not mistaken.
After next year, yeah.
And he's been awful this year. I mean, Marian Gaborik has got 8 goals in, 28 games, 29 games? I mean, he's not producing, and he's fallen in John Tortorella's doghouse. When he was in Winnipeg, sure, I mean, Marian Gaborik's got tons of skill, but he's not finishing. And as far as moving a player, if I'm the Rangers, I'm looking at it from maybe would I do it, and, you know, thankfully the GMs don't call me when they're making a decision. But looking at it from an analytical point of view, I mean, yeah, move Gabrick. He's not really playing for what he's worth, Dave. But you're going to have to move him if you want to get, especially a defenseman of the quality of Dan Boyle.
Well, you got to think that Gabrick is on the way out in New York. I mean, we saw the way he was playing here in Winnipeg, and if you watch some of the Rangers games, he just seems to have fallen out of favor with Tortorella, and it just appears that he could be a piece. A lot of teams would be still interested in because he could be a reclamation project, if you want to use that term, for any sort of, you know, coach who can really get, you know, the best out of him. So, you know, is it? I mean, it's of course, it's like anything. Anything is possible at this point.
And Richard's contract's really killing them. The 6.6 for forever, really. I mean, it didn't really make sense to me then. An older player, Calgary and New York bidding. So you knew something was wrong there. If that was the case, guys. Quickly before we go to break, Brendan Morrow is bandied about a lot, and Dallas is struggling. Veteran player Brendan Morrow and Jágr have kind of both been discussed. Do you guys see both players being dealt, considering Dallas really can't be the team that make a run this year, and these guys are both, you know, are getting older, and they've seen their better days, frankly.
Richie, George Johnson of the Calgary Herald wrote a really good article, I believe it was yesterday, big good friend of the show, we had him on, I believe 2 weeks ago, comparing Brendan Morrow and Jerome Iginla, and really they are in a similar position. Both guys have only been with one franchise. Yep. Yes, Iginla was drafted by Dallas, but he's essentially been with one franchise his entire career, and both of those guys are actually... If you look at their skill sets, Iginla is a better player, I think everyone would agree. But both of those guys can score. Both of those guys will drop the gloves. They're physical. It's actually a very similar situation. Dallas is not rebuilding, and they actually decided to go with veterans. And we kind of argued this early in the season and in the offseason that, okay, but you're also trying to fill seats because you haven't been able to fill seats and they have new ownership. But they went out and they got Jágr. They went out and got Whitney. They acquired Eakin, Roy. So they're not they're not rebuilding. I mean, the Dallas Stars are going for the playoffs. So it's same position, Richie. Dallas and Calgary, at this point, they're not out of the playoffs, but they're not exactly in it either. So you have these guys that both have, let's be honest, 3-4 years each left as productive NHLers. Maybe Iggy will surprise us and play into his early 40s like Solani. But both of these guys are in similar situations on similar teams where they want to win, but the teams that have them won't trade them unless they say, okay, can you please trade me? And if those guys have earned the respect, if they say please trade me, and then they have that no movement clause, they'll get their wish.
Both are UFAs. Brendan Morrow has a no trade clause locked in. Jágr doesn't, but we'll see where that goes. It's gonna be interesting. Trade deadline is 2 weeks today, guys. 2 weeks today. I mean, that's
we'll be live on air.
We'll be live on air. 6-8 as always, and I'm gonna be sitting in with Rick Ralph from the 1290 Roundtable.
You're doing double duty.
Are you? That's news to me.
I'm not so sure that...
Breaking news.
The way Remus said that, it sounded like he didn't okay it. Does Remus get the final okay?
I have no say.
You get a rubber stamp?
I have no say.
He actually has a rubber
stamp. Come on,
Remus.
After the break, we're going to go with 6 things that Dave and Ezzy learned this week, or 3 each. 3 plus 3 is 6, of course. You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve live on TSN 1290. Closing in on 10 to 7, you're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve on TSN 1290. I'm Richard Pollock, filling in the host chair for Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg, David Manouk of IllegalCurve.com, and Michael Remus on loan from the 1290 Roundtable. And of course, currently in a spat with Shane Knighty.
Come on.
Have you seen Shane? I mean, he's still pretty fit. I mean... He works out. I'd be careful, Reem.
I know one thing about Remus. He doesn't work out. But that's not one of the 6 things that I learned or you guys learned this week.
Six. 6 things we learned this week.
Commence countdown. 6.
Well, Richie, I'll just jump in here. My first thing I learned this week, Remus needs to start working out.
The first thing you really learned this week, Ezzy, the Anaheim Ducks. Late-round draft picks have been contributing greatly to the team's success.
Well, you look at the Ducks, how they're currently constructed, right, Richie? We've had Dan Wood on a couple times this week. And when you look at the Ducks, you think of the big line of Corey Perry, Ryan Getzlaff, and Bobby Ryan. But what they've actually done is they've put Matt Beleski on that line certain points of the year, and actually as it stands now going into the game against the Chicago Blackhawks. But if you go up and down the list of the Anaheim Ducks, You've got Emerson Edom, who's got a couple points in the last few games. He hasn't been up with the Ducks for the whole season. Emerson Edom was a late first-rounder in 2010. Mm-hmm. You've got Kyle Palmieri, who was a late first-rounder in 2009. You've got Brandon McMillan, who was a late-round draft pick. You've got Matt Bolesky, who was, I believe, don't have it in front of me, I think he was a 2008 draft pick, and he's been playing in the AHL for the last 3 years. Last year was his first full NHL season. But if you look at what the Ducks are doing, and this is important for Jets fans that are listening as well, I mean, you've got a very good team in Anaheim, which is evidenced by the fact they're in second, and they've only lost five or six games so far this year. But you look at what they've done, and they've developed these guys in the AHL, and they've got guys, and they're not going to be confused for Ryan Nugent-Hopkins or Nail Yakupov, but these guys are producing, and they've stayed up. Emerson Edom is a guy that tore up the WHL, and he's got lots of offensive talent, and he's getting a chance on the top six, top two lines. And the Ducks have a lot of depth, and they're giving their youngsters a lot of time to develop right now on a good team.
Bolesky was a fourth-round pick, as you
to your
point.
Yeah, late rounder, yeah.
112th overall in the 2006 draft by Anaheim.
Five.
Sticking with the Ducks theme, Dave, you're impressed with the ownership, putting up big bucks and trying to win now.
Well, it's clear to anybody who's watching that Anaheim is for real right now. They're not going to sell the farm, and they've signed their two biggest players to eight-year deals, respectively. And it's clear that Henry Samuelli is going to he's playing to win for right now. So, I mean, like, it's interesting to me because Anaheim isn't playing to big crowds, which is interesting, considering how many people are. I think they were like 13,000 at one of their recent games. So that's a kind of a shame because they've got the second-best team right now in the Western Conference.
And it's a shame because if you watch them play, there's no more exciting team in hockey to watch. It's not close, really. They're the most exciting team in hockey to watch, and it's unfortunate that it's not sold out.
Four.
Back to Ezzy, you're pretty impressed, and I like this one, you're pretty impressed at how Steven Stamkos has evolved not only to being a goal scorer, but also to being a playmaker.
Guys, as you know, on this show, we've broken down the Tampa Bay power play, which is very good, and unfortunately, they're struggling right now. But everyone knows that Steven Stamkos is a sniper. He had 60 last year. You know, he'd probably get 60 if this was a full season this year.
Yep.
He's leading the NHL. I think he has 22 now, 21, just got his 200th career goal. But Steven Stamkos has turned into a pretty good passer. And if you look at, you know, what's happened in his first few years in the NHL, who's he played with most of the time? Marty St. Louis, and he's played a lot in the power play, and he's got some goals on the power play. Steven Stamkos has actually added another element to his game, and he's turned into a pretty good playmaker. And it's not just, you know, getting secondary assist and all that. He's really learned from playing with Martin St. Louis, who I believe is one of the best playmakers in the NHL. There's some other good ones as well. Joe Thornton being one of them, Pavel Datsyuk, guys that can get you the puck. He is turning into that. He's adding that element to his game. And, you know, when he does, he might be able to get 120, 130 points.
Three.
Dave, you don't get why mandating visors is so difficult considering junior and college players have to wear a cage and visors respectively.
I mean, this is something we've already discussed today on the show, and it boggles my mind because we've got 73, according to Matthew Schneider, 73% of NHLers currently wearing it. So we're really catering to a minority viewpoint in this regard.
Two.
Every offseason, there's some projects, and Peter Mueller will be one of them, Ezzy. But there's one especially that you've taken a liking to this year, and that's Brad Boyes on the island.
Richie, Brad Boyes right now is playing at a point-per-game clip. He's got 25 points playing on the top line for the New York Islanders. Okay, nobody, including any of us in this room, thought that Brad Boyes was going to put up these type of numbers. You remember Brad Boyes had 43 goals with the St. Louis Blues. The guy is a sniper.
He can shoot.
Brad Boyes isn't the fastest skater, and he fell out of favor with the Buffalo Sabres. He had a couple of terrible years with the Buffalo Sabres, and he got a good contract, a big contract. He was, I believe it was 2 years, $10 million for Brad Boyes, and he didn't play very well. Brad Boyes, this year, as I mentioned, he's playing on the top line, and he's got, I believe, 8 or 9 goals, and he's feeding the puck to John Tavares. Sure, you look at that and you say, okay, he's playing with John Tavares.
Yeah.
I could get 27, 25 points playing with John Tavares. That's not the case. And you know what? For a guy that they gave a one-year, $1 million contract for, I think more people should be talking about this because it's a really good story.
One.
Dave liked when Bufflin passed the puck yesterday night to Bogosian, who shot the puck towards the net, and Wheeler tipped it in. He didn't want to see Olli Jokinen on the point.
No, I think the Olli Jokinen on the point experiment has to be over in Winnipeg. The power play, finally showing some power in the power play. I mean, especially now that Toby Enstrom is back wearing a regular jersey. Hopefully we'll see him in the lineup soon, and that really is who we need to see on the point. No more Olli Jokinen.
Which is funny because there's some talk between the break that the Drumandel experiment was over on the Elite Hockey Show.
Absolutely.
It took us, 4 years to figure that out.
My time to shine.
1 hour down, 1 hour to go. You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve live on TSN 1290. Joined in the studio by Ezra Ginsberg, David Manuka of IllegalCurve.com. And if you don't know, IllegalCurve.com is the place to be for all your Jets news. Michael Remus is producing our show and simultaneously looking to buy Shane Natty jerseys on eBay.
I thought I'd get in his good books, right? Is that a way to do it?
You want to do like mid-2000s sends? Like, why don't you wear... You'll buy the Shane Natty jersey. I think they played the same time. Why doesn't Ezzy buy a Lance Pitlick jersey? Number two, I believe he was.
Those would be great to wear for a shinny.
Or maybe going back to the inaugural year of post-expansion, Brad Marsh.
Brad Marsh. He's got a bar there. Marshy's, I think it's called. I wonder how they came up with that.
Yeah, Reem, maybe if you show up to the MTS Center wearing a Shane Knighty Boston Bruins jersey, he'll forgive you.
Will be over. They'll squash the beef.
I think of him as more of a send, though. That was more the core of his career.
I would agree. Those playoff battles with the Leafs.
Of course, I don't think he played on the Washington Capitals. And we're now going to break down... The Washington Capitals penalty kill. 2 weeks ago, we broke down their power play, or 3 weeks ago, we broke down their power play. They're, of course, in town the next two nights. And their power play, before we get started, the power play was really focused on a 1-3-1, meaning Mike Green or John Carlson at the top of the blue line, Alexander Ovechkin kind of on the top of the left circle, Troy Brouwer in the middle in the high slot, either Mike Ribeiro, who's having a good year, or Nicholas Backstrom on the right hash marks, and then whoever isn't on the right hash marks of Ribeiro and Backstrom on the goal line. They have a dangerous power play, but they have an awful penalty kill.
Break it down.
It's an odd series that the Jets have coming up. And, I heard Claude Noel before on H&L talk about how he doesn't really consider it back-to-back, considers it two games. You can consider it whatever you want, but I think a key to the next two games is going to be taking advantage of the poor Washington penalty kill, which, of course... I mean, the Jets also have a poor power play right now. But it is important. The Washington Capitals penalty kill, guys, is ranked 29th in the NHL. So as good as their power play is, their penalty kill is just as bad. And you're going to see in the next couple days the likes of Brouwer and Hendricks killing penalties, Joel Ward, Marcus Johansson, Jay Beagle, and then you'll see Nicholas Backstrom and even Eric Fair is killing penalties. And I think part of the problem, before we get into kind of the scheme and what they do, guys, part of the problem is who they really have on the penalty kill.
Right, Richie, and we talked about this last week when we were breaking down special teams, as we do every week on the midweek show. But really, the special teams are a mixture of personnel and schemes. I mean, look at the Boston Bruins, and we talked about that. You put a guy like Jay Pandolfo, who hasn't played much this year, but if you have a good scheme, it works. Jay Pandolfo happens to be a veteran penalty killer. So it's not just the personnel. It's not just the scheme. And if you have the right scheme and the right personnel, really, it's easy. And your penalty kill and your power play can be a difference maker. Right now, for both the Jets and the Capitals, because, guys, the Jets are bottom 10 in both penalty kill and power play right now. Right now, the Jets have won 5 of 7. And right now, it's their special teams that is really the only thing that's holding them back.
Well, it's interesting with the Capitals is how many players they're using on their penalty kill. It's not like they're using a set, like, three, four guys. That's their core group. They are just throwing everybody out there. And, it's an interesting, way. And it's obviously not having much success considering they're currently killing at 75.9%.
And you're going to see tomorrow and Friday, if you assume the Jets do draw penalties, is going to be a team that doesn't really pressure too much in the offensive and neutral zone. I mean, they're going to kind of throw one guy at you and have three guys lined up at the blue line. But over... really noticeable watching this team on tape is that they back off pretty quickly off the blue line. So you really can enter the zone, I think, pretty easily against this team. That's one of the first problems. Some really good penalty killing squads are able to get you at the line, at the blue line, and to get the puck down the ice before you even get in the zone.
And I know, Richie, you want to go more into the personnel and the scheme of the Capitals, but just quickly, what I said to you in the press box last night about the Boston Bruins and their penalty kill, and the Jets popped in a power play goal, is they'll actually give you tons of room, but they'll give you that room, and then Zdeno Chara will greet you at the blue line with a body check. So that's what they rely on, Johnny Boychuk, physical defenseman, you know, closing those gaps at the blue line. So the Washington Capitals don't have a Zdeno Chara or a Johnny Boychuk or a Dennis Seidenberg, and I think that's what their problem is. They've kind of got more speedy offensive guys, less physical guys on defense, with maybe the exception being Alzner, Schultz. But anyways, I just wanted to throw that
in. And it's important, as I think Alzner's their best defensive defenseman. I think overall personnel, we get back to, you know, a guy like Jeff Schultz, big guy, but isn't physical. They don't clear the net very well. That's one thing you'll see tomorrow and Friday. They don't clear the net well. And if the Jets can have a net front presence, they're going to have an issue with it in Washington. Whereas, as you mentioned, as Boston, go ahead and get in, you know, get in the way of Chara and those guys. I mean, even if they front you, meaning they stand in front of the forwards, they're so big, the puck is hard to get by. The Capitals line up in a kind of a traditional box format. You know, picture it, you know, as two forwards at the top of the box and two defensemen at the bottom of the box. Their forward, when the puck's, you know, at the top of this, top of the blue line, the forward who's covering that defenseman isn't overly aggressive. So the Capitals overall, their penalty kill isn't very aggressive. So if you're, you know, if you can pick some seams on them, you can have some good success. I've noticed that when the forward covering the puck gets too aggressive, a lot of the times the other forward he's working with will try and take away the backdoor pass, but they do get distracted, and it allows for a pass into the high slot, which is not necessarily an area the Jets use a lot. So you have to wonder if the Jets maybe adjust what they're doing tomorrow and Friday to take advantage of what the Washington Capitals do on the penalty kill. But one thing also to note, guys, when the puck gets below the hash marks and even below the goal line, Washington collapses. And that, to me, works in the Jets' favor, as because if the Jets get the puck back to the point, the defensemen, you know, Bogosian, Big Shot, Bufflin, Big Shot, that could be trouble for Washington, and that could create great opportunities for Winnipeg.
Yeah, Richie, and we should mention that, you know, the Capitals, as we know, are coached by Adam Oates, and Adam Oates is the type of guy that puts a lot of emphasis into the penalty kill. And, you know, having Joe Beninati on the show and having Chuck Gormley, who writes for CSN, in Washington, it's something that they know about. And it's funny when you mention how they're not aggressive. You know, when you look at one of the guys that I mentioned a few weeks ago, maybe even a month ago, that I really like what he does on the penalty kill, pardon me, is Brouwer. But the problem is they don't have a lot of guys like Troy Brouwer. He's one of the only guys who can be a little bit more aggressive. But I think you're right. The collapsing down low element is something that the Jets haven't really succeeded at. And let's be honest, the Jets' power play, sure, it started to get going here. But against a team like the Washington Capitals, you might even be able to really get it going, start moving the puck around, get Kane moving around, even put Wellwood out there, get some movement on the half boards, as opposed to really the one set play that the Jets have, which is Hockey 101, which is put Antropov in front of the net, put Ladd in front of the net, and let Buff or Bogo rip it.
And that's a good point, Ezzie, because one thing you're going to see is if the forward on the Capitals is too aggressive, and the other forward who he's killing the penalty with is trying to cover up, you know, the middle for a seam pass, if the Jets work it around to one of Bogosian or Bufflin on an off wing for a one-timer, that could really, a lot of teams are able to do that against them, quick puck movement ending up in a one-timer, because Washington gets too low in their own zone, and they get too low off the points, and the Jets kind of work from the points. So I do think that actually suits them quite well to take advantage of this penalty kill, and I think it'll be very interesting to see how these teams adjust, because you never see it. Two games in the same barn, back-to-back. I mean, it's kind of like a playoff series in that way, guys. You kind of, you know, you can throw the stats out the window a little bit after probably game one or two. Now, there's no more than two here, but because you're only playing against this one team that in night two on Friday, I bet you'll see a lot of adjustments from those two teams after playing each other two nights in a row.
Well, I mean, it's also, I mean, we're talking, it's not even like a playoff, because in a playoff, you usually have a day off in between. Mm-hmm. This is 25 hours. So you really are going to be, you know, as soon as that game ends, they're going to have to do some serious video work.
Yep.
Because you're going to be, it's not like you have the usual turnaround to say, okay, what did we do wrong? What did we do right? Now let's break it down. You literally have to go through the night, break that down, so you'll have it ready to go for the next day.
You won't be on the, you won't be on the ice for probably a, you know, hard practice or even focusing on those things. And there hasn't been much time to practice at all, Ezzie, in this lockout shortened season. But Dave's right. It's important. That video work's going to be extra, you know, is extremely important based upon the schedule.
Well, you talk about the keys to the game, right? And, you know, when we're watching games on TSN, you know, they throw out the keys to the game, and we hear the tired cliches about getting pucks in deep and establishing a forecheck. But, you know, penalty kill is an area where Washington is weak. So, really, it wouldn't be a bad idea for the Jets to really focus in on that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Claude Noel, you know, Dave Minuk posts more Claude Noel audio than anybody.
On IllegalCurve.com.
And he's heard more audio than anybody. And he mentioned yesterday, you know, we got a power play goal. And he mentioned that a week ago when the power play was even worse. And, you know, it's funny. They do work on it. But really, it's going to be interesting to see if they do anything about it. Because really, you get an opportunity here to play a team, and it is a mini-series. I know Claude Noel is just saying, oh, it's two games.
Sure.
It's a mini-series, and it's against a team that you can basically eliminate from the playoffs if you beat them twice.
Claude Noel has been speaking a lot about special teams, and it's kind of like in football, do you win the turnover battle? And I think that's kind of become one of his mottos is, you know, do we win special teams battle? Well, in this situation, it's, you know, stats-wise, the Jets aren't good at either, that being penalty kill or power play. But if you look at Washington, they're extremely good at one, and extremely poor at the other. And I wouldn't be shocked if you looked at it at the end of this two-game series, and the special teams winner, in terms of who got better output on the power play or penalty kill, was the winner in both games. And that's an obvious statement most times because, of course, success and goals, they're hard to come by. But I think it's extremely important in a game like in a little series like this.
Well, what happened yesterday? The Boston Bruins, as we'd probably all agree, Richie, and I know you did the podcast with Drew, who is right now on the sunny beaches of Columbia, maybe, or maybe not quite yet. But you know, the power play goal in the third period changed everything. I mean, the Bruins were dominating, and that power play goal really changed things. And they don't score that power play goal. You know, it's a huge factor in the game. So I agree. And this is, you know, something the Washington Capitals, you know, they're going to look back on the season. And, you know, they haven't gotten the goaltending they've wanted from Braden Holtby. And there have been many issues. Alexander Ovechkin hasn't had his best year. But when it comes down to the penalty kill, that's also a huge negative on your year.
It sure helped to have a guy like Andre Kopitar on the power play, or Mike Richards or Jeff Carter. And we might as well talk about those three players, amongst others, after the break with Jim Fox, great friend of the show, color commentator for the LA Kings on television with Bob Miller, and has been doing it for many years. That's one of the best combos. If you're watching the late night NHL Center Ice, that's one of the great combos you're going to hear, and we're going to talk to Jim after the break. You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve live on TSN 1290. Host chair for Drew Mandel, joined in the studio by Ezra Ginsberg, David Minuk of IllegalCurve.com, and Michael Remus on loan from the 1290 Roundtable with Rick Ralph.
The TSN 1290 NHL Midweek Hotline.
We're joined on the line by Jim Fox, television color analyst for the LA Kings on Fox Sports West. We haven't spoken to Jim in a while, I believe, since the Kings have won the Cup. Jim, how are you doing?
Doing great, guys. How's it? What's up going on there?
Oh, you know, it's about 64 feet of snow, Jim, but spring is tomorrow, so...
Today.
Today, sorry. Is it 21st or 20th?
20th,
okay.
Yeah, first day of spring.
First day of spring. Well, you wouldn't know it here. That was the joke in town, and of course the Kings aren't in town this year, but will be next year when the Jets move to the Western Conference. And for people who haven't really seen the Kings play this year, Jim, coming off the Stanley Cup victory and a tremendous performance throughout the playoffs last year, is there, you know, one specific change that you've seen with this squad, or have they kept things relatively seamless coming into the season?
Well, the biggest change was created by injury, and it affected two big defensemen, Willie Mitchell and Matt Green. So that's been an adjustment that the team has had to make. They lost Mitchell before the season started, and they lost Matt Green in the first game. So basically all season long, it's been without their two biggest stay-at-home defensemen. The biggest adjustment they've had to make has been on the penalty kill, because that was the first pair that usually came over the boards for the Kings in penalty kills last year. Other than that, it's been pretty much the same. Jonathan Quick had off-season back surgery. He's been pretty good. It's just not as sharp as he was. You know, he was certainly last year in the playoffs, and I think understandably so, coming off of back surgery. Mm-hmm. Of late, he's been turning it around, but everything else has been just about the same going into the season. They really didn't make any changes whatsoever. One of the few teams that has won a championship and really had the whole roster coming back. Having said that, the one thing that is apparent is that the Kings are scoring more. They're much more offensively oriented this year than they were in the past.
Jim, you know, it's. I think you'd agree that it's tough to believe that Drew Doughty just scored his first goal of the season last night, but that's the case. And do you think that, you know, this is a classic year of the stats lie about his performance? Because he's been pretty good out there.
He's still the Kings' best defenseman. I don't think there's any question about that. I think he's still a top 10 defenseman in the National Hockey League. I don't think there's any question there. I think what's happened, the two guys I was just talking about, Green and Mitchell, go out of the lineup, and all of a sudden Drew Doughty now has to take their role over. He has to be the first guy out on the penalty kill. So the biggest thing that's changed there is that now Drew Doughty is expending energy much more in defensive situations than in offensive situations. He's had to change his game for the team. And, you know, Daryl Sutter was talking the other day, the head coach, about Drew and saying that he's made four or five mistakes all season long. And that's about it. They're getting everything they possibly can from him. The offense hasn't been there. It has been frustrating to him. He has been getting going in at the same time right now, doing what they're asking. And that's playing solid defense and shutting down the other team's.
The pride of Kenora, Ontario, Mike Richards, his ice time is down across the board this season. Is there any particular reason you think that is happening?
Well, he just had a slow start due to, we assume, fitness. Some players were able to come back a little bit quicker off the lockout, and some took a little bit longer. I talked to Mike at the time at the start of the season, and, you know, about five or six games in, and really nothing happening offensively for Mike, and he just said the little plays that he's used to making, the passes under and over sticks and between skates and between legs and things of that sort, just didn't have that feel and touch yet. And he talked about the physical play, you know, just getting back into it and grinding it. But in all honesty, over the last 15 games, he has really turned it on. And offensively now, it just seems like every time he has the puck, something's happening. So slow start. We assume it had to do with fitness, but certainly right back to normal now. Maybe even a little bit better again this year offensively. Mm-hmm. As far as the numbers go per game or per minute played than it was last year.
We're joined by Jim Fox, the LA Kings color analyst in Fox Sports West, with, of course, Bob Miller, one of the best duos you're going to see out there. Jim, you know, when you watch this team play, and to me, you know, you're a champion until you're defeated, and I watch the Kings on the late broadcast a lot. Is there a team that's better below the hash marks in the offensive zone at controlling the puck than LA?
You know, that's the way they won the Cup. I mean, that's what they did. They just spent so much time in the offensive zone. And nothing has really changed up there. I think, you know, Jeff Carter is involved more so this year. He joined the team late last year. So it adds a little bit more skill, but it also adds another player with size. So that's the factor. I think that, you know, the top two, like most teams, that your top six have the guys that are kind of sniper-oriented or passing and creative. And then the bottom six, if you want to call it, with the Kings, it's just all big bodies. I mean, it's just big body after big body, and they wear down on you. And if you look this year, at the goal differential in the first period, the Kings are a minus, about minus four or five, but then it gets better, and it gets better, where the Kings are the best third-period team in the league. So I think that's part of what you're talking about, that down-low grind. You're in a situation where you're just putting big bodies on the other team's defense, and, you know, sooner or later you kind of grind it down and you wear them down, and then you find yourself, you know, spending a lot of time down low. It is something they work on. They know it's their strength, and it's something they play to.
Jim, with about 17 or 18 games to go, you know, the Los Angeles Kings are in fourth place here in the West. They've won 7 out of 10. They've won 3 in a row. Does this team have a weakness right now?
You know, that's a good question. It's similar to last year when they went into the season, and I felt, you know, they didn't have a glaring weakness, a glaring hole to fill. If anything, again, it's finding, you know, they're playing young defensemen in situations that, you know, they probably wouldn't be there except for the injuries. So if there's one thing, if you look at the numbers, it would be the penalty kill. Again, that's part the sharpness of the goaltending, and then it's part just having, again, your two best, you know, defensemen for that situation not being available and having to play other guys there. So if there's a concern right now, it would be, I think, in that area specifically on the penalty kill, and even more specifically just, you know, a lot of youth back on the blue line. So I'm sure there's a lot of teams that are looking for defensemen. And the Kings, you know, if they were, they wouldn't be looking for a 6 or 7, 8 or 5. They'd be looking for a top 4 defenseman. But I assume that line is very long for a lot of teams looking for that. So It's something they're trying to get by. Jake Muzzin's been real good. Slava Voynov's been good. Again, Doughty, just all the youth has been coming up and playing pretty well. But that is kind of an uncertain part of the Kings right now.
Jim, coming off the Cup victory, do you think the lockout helped or hurt the Kings?
Well, you know what? Everyone thought that the Stanley Cup hangover would not be an issue because of the extended period of time off. I will tell you this. I've gone through it as a staff member, not as a player, but we just went through it, and it exists. And it's something that is almost uncontrollable. Again, with a long time off, most people thought it wasn't going to be there, but you know what? What you end up doing, first of all, is for the players, they end up, instead of honing their skills and getting ready for the season, they spend the off season, and I don't care if it's 3 weeks, 4 weeks, or 4 months, they spend it rehabbing. I mean, they have to take care of injuries. They've got things going on. Then you just have the mental grind, and I'm going to call it a grind. I mean, everything that was associated with the Kings this summer was all positive. It was all around the Stanley Cup, but you never have a day off, and you always have to be on, and I think that wears you down mentally. I think it's just natural. I don't think you can do anything to prevent it, and it's something that, again, because of the lockout, the Kings thought they had under control coming in the year, but once the season started, you know, that gearing up effect, it just takes another mindset to get back into it. And the Kings didn't make that shift. So most people thought it would kind of help them. Slow start when you look at where they are right now. I mean, they've been real good the last, 15 games. Real good. So that slow start kind of hurt them. It probably went back to what happened last year. But I guess we'd take that trade-off every year if that was the case.
Exactly. We're joined by Jim Fox, color analyst for the LA Kings on Fox Sports West. Jim, you mentioned the youth on defense and a player who played really well last year, but seems to even have come further into his own this year. And I think one thing that the term I would use to describe him would be mature beyond his years, and that's Slava Voynov. Can you talk about his progression?
Yeah, he has a real good understanding of the game. It's better than good. I think the comparison is Sergei Zubov, where he understands, the flow of the game. He's not overly aggressive. At the same time, he's very competitive. And he gets himself in a situation where you always have to be in good position first because he's not the biggest guy. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that he's working on right now is just, getting better every day. And he has a fluidity to his game. He has a seamless type of nature to his game. He has something that a lot of players, take, as you're mentioning, a lot longer to figure out. But he's done that. And I think, when you look at the coaching staff and his teammates, they look to him right now as a guy that they're counting on. I mean, it showed in the playoffs last year. But to be honest, again, it's not the same situation because playoffs and regular season are not the same. But this year, I mean, he has been the most consistent defenseman, I'll give him that. And that's something that, any team can use. How he gets better, it's just continuing to go and continuing to understand the game a little bit better. But I don't even know how he could improve there because that's his biggest asset, that understanding point. So he can log a lot of minutes. He's probably more competitive than people would give him credit for when they watch him for the first time. But when you see him bear down on a situation, you understand how he gets the job done because he's just on you and he won't give up.
Jim, there's a player that you mentioned that I have to ask you about. And, the guys in the room will back me up. I was tweeting about him how I really like the way he plays, and that's Jake Muzzin, the pride of Woodstock, Ontario. People are now talking about him as a possible Calder Trophy nominee. He's got 12 points. He's plus 14. How surprising has the play of Jake Muzzin been this year for you?
Well, I think it's been, I think he was always on the radar. He was on the radar last year, but he only played a handful of games. This year, coming into camp, he didn't make the team, but then right away because of the injuries, but he went down and just continued to excel. I think when you look and you hear the phrase, the ceiling, the high ceiling, his ceiling is as high as anyone. It really is. I mean, he is big, he is fast, he's powerful, and he has a great shot. I mean, I think he has the hardest shot on the Kings. We haven't had a skills competition to verify that recently, but it comes off his stick as fast as anyone. So you put that all together, and now it's back to the same thing young defensemen go through. It's the understanding. It's the read of the play. It's the knowing when to be over-aggressive and when to back off and delay and just hold on and get some help. And so far it seems to be going well that way for Jake. I would agree to put his name in the Calder Trophy candidates right now. I mean, because of the ice time he's getting and the situation and the numbers he's putting up, having said that, it's still, with the ceiling he has, you always get that feeling he still has a ways to go, because you just see every night certain elements of his game that are right at the top, and it's all about putting it all together. And once that happens, I think then you've got Doughty, you've got Voinoff, you've got Muzzin, three young defensemen that have a chance to be around for a long, long period of time. And I'm not counting the older guys, because they're going to be with us too, but these guys will continue to get better, and then they'll be a core for a long period of time.
Luxury most teams would like to have. Jim Fox, nobody knows the Kings better. Thank you so much for joining us on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve.
Guys, my pleasure. Anytime. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Jim.
After the break, we're going to break down Carolina's prospects. They're in the bottom third of the National Hockey League in terms of ranking, but there are a couple guys to keep your eye on, and one's name is Stalk. You're listening to NHL Midweek on the with the Illegal Curve, on TSN 1290. Two segments to go. Six down. Excuse me, Richard Pollock filling the host chair for Drew Mindell. Joined in studio by Michael Remus, Ezra Ginsberg, and David Manouk of IllegalCurve.com. You heard him coughing right there. That's a heck of a presence he has on this show.
It's true.
If you're just tuning in, you missed Jim Fox, L.A. King television color analyst on Fox Sports West with Bob Miller earlier in the show.
He's the best. Jim is the best. If you haven't listened to that combo, Richie, you mentioned it earlier. Unbelievable.
A great combo. I'll tell you right now, the two guests tonight's show are long-time guests on Illegal Curve.
In any incarnation.
And two of the classiest guys in the business, and two of the most knowledgeable guys in the business. Always a pleasure having them on. You really get to know more about what's going on in Anaheim, more about what's going on in L.A., and let's be honest, guys, that could very well be the Western Conference final this year.
Yep.
And that would be a heck of a rivalry, only about half an hour away from each other.
We'll have to play a lot of Eagles if they meet in the Western Conference Finals.
Hotel California?
That's right.
Really?
Get out.
Prospect Balls.
Really?
We saw the Eagles, by the way. Let's bring KK in, okay, Richie? You're giving me,
We're joined on the line by Kyle Kozier of Veritas Hockey, our scouting correspondent. Kyle, before we get into the Carolina Hurricanes prospects, which, by the way, we're working our way from the bottom up. So the Carolina
Hurricanes.
Just like
Drake.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Started from the bottom, now we hear.
Is that what it was?
Drake. It's the new Drake song. Come on, Reem. We'll have to cue that up. Come on, Richie.
Kyle, do you want to just hang up now or what?
No, I'll see what. I enjoy the banter, and it's easier than getting to my radio.
Well, if you were here in person, you get to see a whole different side of it, as I do. Kyle, the Carolina Hurricanes are ranked. We're basing everything on Hockey's Future, of course, and Hockey's Future, which is a prospect website, has the Carolina Hurricanes ranked 25th out of 30 teams in terms of prospect, one being the best, 30th being the worst. Carolina Hurricanes are battling it out with the Winnipeg Jets right now for the Southeast Division crown. There are other teams, obviously, in the mix, but Carolina and Winnipeg are the two teams that are at the top as we speak. But we want to delve into their prospect pool. And I guess let's start with Keegan Lowe.
Yeah, it's obviously, I'm sure everybody is familiar with the last name. He certainly is Keegan Lowe's son. He was a third-round draft pick here a couple of years back and really kind of drafted him as a project. He doesn't really have a clear, a clear-cut strength, but has really kind of developed into a leader for the Oil Kings. He's puts up a lot of penalty minutes this year, kind of can play that tough guy, shutdown role, fights a little bit. That said, he's also, having sort of a career year points-wise. Of course, he's a 20-year-old now, but I think he has about, 15 goals and, maybe about 45 points all told. So, has a bit of an offensive element to his game. That said, I think if he moves on to the NHL, you probably see him in that shutdown type of role, because he has a size for his about 6'2", 200, and if he can bring some of that meanness his dad exhibited, he's probably the better fit for him in the professional game.
KK, I wanted to ask you about Riley Nash. Actually, on last week's show, after we had you on, I actually mentioned him as a guy to keep your eye on. as you know, the Edmonton Oilers drafted him and gave up on him, I guess, if you want to look at it like that, and traded him to the Carolina Hurricanes back in 2010 for, yeah, I think it was a second rounder, and now he's actually sticking with him, but he's still a top prospect. What do you like or dislike about Riley Nash's game, and do you think the Edmonton Oilers maybe made a mistake by trading him?
Well, I don't know that it was necessarily a mistake. I think it was a situation where they didn't think that Nash was going to sign with them. And on Nash's part, I think, you know, one of his strengths is his intelligence, plays a very, very smart game. You know, doesn't put up big numbers, but again, very smart player, can kind of adapt to whatever situation is needed. And I think he kind of, you know, saw the writing on the wall with the forwards that Edmonton was drafting, and, you know, maybe didn't really see a place for himself on that lineup, which I guess is a fair assumption. That said, he still has some value. The Oilers were able to turn him into a second rounder, which is, you know, fairly good value for both sides, and both sides seem happy with what they got out of it. So, again, when you're looking at him from the Carolina perspective, you do look at the hockey smarts he has there. He can play that two-way game, has a little bit of offensive ability. One of those guys that the coach probably feels comfortable with plugging in almost anywhere. And, you know, hopefully it's a good fit for Carolina. You want to see a guy get a shot, and it looks like he's going to get it in Carolina.
Kyle, arguably the top prospect in the Carolina system is Victor Rask. He's a second-round pick in the 2011 entry draft, Swedish center, excuse me.
Yeah.
What do you like about his game, and, you know, what are the Hurricanes projecting for maybe his ceiling?
Well, I think they're probably projecting him to be, you know, probably topped out as a second-line center, but more realistically, probably a third-liner. You know, when you talk to the guys from the Calgary Hitmen, one of the things they talk about all the time is that he plays, you know, sort of a throwback centerman role, where he focuses a lot on his defensive responsibilities, on the faceoffs, guy you can trust up here at the end of the game. So for a team like Carolina to have another guy like that take some of the pressure off, say a guy like Eric Staal, that's a real big deal for them. So obviously they're, I don't want to say stacked at center, but they have some real good centers coming in. So that's the guy they can slot in on their third line going forward. I think they'd be doing well. And Calgary obviously was thrilled to get him back this year from Charlotte. So I think that really speaks highly towards, you know, his character and what he means for a junior team at this point, and hopefully for a professional team going forward.
KK, most people are familiar with the name Staal, and there's Jared Staal, who's the who's on in this draft pool. What do you think of him?
Well, he's sort of, I don't see the forgotten guy, but, you know, certainly doesn't get all the that his debtors get. He wasn't a high pick. He went to Phoenix and eventually kind of made his way to Carolina through a trade. He's quite big, you know, 6'4", 200, plays the right wing, has the right hand of shot, which is also different from his brothers, and really projects more of an energy guy. Doesn't really have the hands or, you know, well, I guess speaking of the other two forwards, but doesn't really have that offensive acumen as they do. That said, there's certainly a role for big guys like that. You know, you talk about coaches now, saying this stuff you can't really quantify, and one of those things is having players that can wear down an opposition defensive core. And that's the type of guy that can do that. Somebody you can throw out there, wear the other team's best guys down, to wear the defense down, and hopefully create room for offensive guys. So, you know, again, if he does make it as an NHLer, it won't be in a scoring role, but, you know, as we all know, especially in today's NHL, there's room for other type of role players too.
We're joined by Kyle Kozier of Veritas Hockey. He's breaking down the Carolina Hurricane system each week on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve. We're talking about a different team system, working our way from the bottom of the NHL based on the hockey's future rankings to the way up. So far, we've broken down the prospects. Keegan Lowe, Victor Rask, Jared Staal, one of the fourth Staal brother, as they say, and Riley Nash.
KK, another guy that I wanted to ask you about was Ryan Murphy. We were in St. Paul when he was drafted. He was drafted 12th overall by the Carolina Hurricanes. And everyone remembers the feel-good story. He finally made the Canadian World Junior team, and he had some offensive success. But the drawback with Ryan Murphy, as you know, seems to be he's smaller and not really able to play a physical brand of hockey. Do you think he's going to be able to adapt at that? And, you know, do you think he's going to be able to maybe crack the roster within the few years, or do you think it's going to be a little bit longer than that?
You know, it may be a little longer for him, and the only reason I say that is, you know, you point to the size, I think it's about 5'11", and in order for those guys to adjust from playing in the OHL to playing against, you know, kids that maybe bigger, but, you know, maybe don't have that older man strength yet. You know, they're only 16, 17, 18. Mm-hmm. Again, when you move up, you're playing older guys that are, you know, have a lot of upper body strength and can force the issue with these defensemen. So in order for him to make that adjustment, he's going to have to learn how to play the finer points of defense a little better. So, again, we all know about his offensive ability, but, you know, can he, you know, keep the puck out of the net too? So that said, there's no real rush to move along guys like that. You know, defensemen sort of as a rule emerge a little later in their careers. So if Carolina is smart and they don't really have a pressing need for the offense he provides from the back line, then maybe that's the guy you can leave in the American League, kind of learn the craft for a few years and maybe have a more rounded prospect when he does, or rather when he's ready to make the jump to the NHL.
Joined by Kyle Kozier, our scouting correspondent. Kyle's in the middle of scouting, of course, so he's kind enough to give a little bit of his time. Kyle, we'll let you go on this last one here. Most NHL fans will know defenseman Erik Karlsson is arguably being the best defenseman in the National Hockey League. Well, the Hurricanes have an Erik Karlsson of their own in their prospect pool, who is also a defenseman.
Yeah. So they have kind of interesting same name, just sort of 4 years apart there too. So
he's still playing over in Sweden.
Obviously, he has no real rush to bring him over, and that is, you know, a lot of his contemporaries are still playing in, you know, junior hockey or high school hockey or that kind of thing too. So bit of an open book on him right now. And he just moved up to the Elite League. I think it was just before Christmas. Seems to be doing, you know, at least reasonably well at that level. It's a big jump going from the Swedish junior into the Elite League. Again, more of a probably a project type of player. The guys, you know, that Carolina probably intends to sit on for a little while to see how things develop. But certainly need to see some of the different names pop up at the prospect pool for sure. And Carlson's another one of those guys.
I should correct myself. Of course, he's a center. I'm looking at the probability of success here on Hockey's Future, Kyle, and it gives me a D, and then I look, and it's not actually it's defenseman. It's a center. So my apologies.
Yeah, center of the wing, yeah.
My apologies there. Kyle, thank you so much for giving me of your time. We'll speak to you next week as we work our way up through the NHL organizational rankings, focusing specifically on prospects.
Anytime, guys. I enjoy it.
Thanks, KK.
Thanks a lot, KK.
You know, the Jets fans are probably less concerned now about Carolina's prospect pool than they were, say, 2 weeks ago before realignment, or 3 weeks ago before realignment was approved, because they're going to see Carolina very rarely now. At the same time, I always, you know, when I'm talking to Jets fans, you know, the Jets have Trouba, of course, Jacob Trouba, and they have Mark Scheifele, and then there are other players, Adam Lowry, other players, but yep. It's always interesting to see what other teams have, in their system, because who's going to be taking, you know, Minnesota's ranked number one in this, and we'll eventually get to them, but the point is, you know, does every team in the league have a Scheifele and Trouba, and if that's the case, then how do the Jets get better and get that advantage?
And we were talking about this off-air, you know, the big issue for the Jets, we're assuming Jacob Trouba is going to play 1 to 3 more years for the University of Michigan. But as far as Mark Scheifele goes, a lot of people ask me, well, one person once asked me, what I think Mark Scheifele, you know, what's his year going to look like next year? I'm not sure. I mean, he could play a year in St. John's. There's a good chance if Barry doesn't go far, he'll play St. John's at the end of the season. They're probably not going to make the playoffs. But, you know, Richie, the Jets don't have the most prospects, and that's why I'm okay with Chevy keeping those 2 second-rounders and those 2 third-rounders for the 2013 draft in New Jersey, because, you know, you got to stock the system. Atlanta, unfortunately, didn't do that good of a job because a lot of the guys they drafted in the first round ended up going right into the NHL.
Guys, one segment left. Where'd the show go?
Where did the show go?
Over-under's coming up, and, of course, we're going to throw it to keep an eye to David, to Ezzy, and I'll throw in a keep an eye on for the upcoming week in the National Hockey League and the upcoming night. Doubleheader on TSN, of course. You're listening to NHL Midweek with The Illegal Curve live on TSN 1290. We got one last chance to make it real. Gonna end off the show with a little Bruce, as we do on Saturdays, and we'll be on this Saturday at noon, of course, The Illegal Curve Hockey Show, 12 to 3 this week. The Jets are not playing on Saturday. Usually we're on 6 hours before puck drop. There is no game, so we're in a regular slot, 12 to 3. If you're ever thinking where is the Legal Curve and when is the Legal Curve on, it's 12 to 3, unless there's a Jets game, and it's 6 hours before a Jets game. So if the Jets play at 6, we're on at noon. If they play earlier like they do next week, Saturday against Carolina, then we're on 6 hours before puck drop.
You can always find that information on a little site called thelegalcurve.com for all your latest Jets news.
Of course, you can follow us on Twitter at @illegalcurve. You can follow ICSEG's thoughts at ICSEG. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/illegalcurve. You can follow us on Instagram. Michael Remus, of course, has been doing a great job with that account in this segment. brought to you by Bernstein's. We should mention, of course, that Bernstein's Deli is getting prepared for Passover, which is Monday and Tuesday night for the non-Jewish folk out there. And then you can put your orders in place, and Marla and Aaron will take care of you over there at Bernstein's.
Well, Richie, don't pass over the chance to go to Bernstein's Deli and get your brisket and gefilte fish. Oh,
I was literally thinking, who is going to make that joke first?
Well, you know how good it was when I pulled out the shofar so good, so for everyone who knows what that is.
As long as you don't pull out, like, a matzo ball out of your pocket, then, then I'll be really concerned.
Well, we've got our quotient of Jewish jokes now.
Final segment, guys, we're going to deal with...
Over Under.
Now... Usually on this show, I mean, this is our sixth show with NHL Midweek. Of course, we've been on for a legal career for longer than that. Drew's been doing these long-winded over-unders. And Michael just doesn't like them.
Well, I never said that.
You said that off air.
Maybe.
You said it.
First one. Ben Hankinson obviously made a stir, with his tweet about free Jake Gardner. Now Jake Gardner, of course, is up, and the Leafs are winning 4-0. Not that there's anything, there's any correlation between the two, but Alan Walsh in the past has tweeted out, you know, with respect to Jaroslav Halak and Carey Price, and they've caused a stir.
Talk about shameless plug.
Exactly. Over under half in terms of 0.5 in terms of tweets from agents causing a stir before the end of the Stanley Cup final.
0.5 is what you're saying.
Yes. Will there be one is what I'm asking.
I think there will, over, for sure. I mean, it seems like Twitter is, it's a marketing tool, right? It's a communication tool and a marketing tool. And I think whether it's Alan Walsh, whether it's Ben Hankinson, I think you can use it to drum up public support. And you get it in the media. We were talking about it on Saturday, you know, free Jake Gardner. We were talking to Michael Tracos of the National Post about it. And, you know, I don't know if it had any impact on it, but it definitely... you know, drums up that public talk, whatever you want to call it. Anyway, so over.
Nobody knows more about social media than Ezra Ginsberg, so he's the foremost authority on tweeting.
Add me on Friendster.
Now, the question is, would you be able to push? What happens if someone tweets and then deletes it? Is that considered a half?
That counts, because once it's out there, it's out there.
Okay. That's
a good question.
Okay, well, you know, we needed to have that.
This is someone who knows the difference between a retweet and a favorite.
Thank you. The answer is over. Ezzy's 100% right. These guys use this for a reason. These guys are always out there. There's absolutely no question that this will happen again this season.
Yeah, hashtag great over-under topic.
It could have been a bit, maybe 1.5 would have been a bit higher.
It's a good point, Reem.
Not to criticize your line or anything.
Over under.
Siskel and Ebert over here.
Do you think when Shane Nadi, Remus's enemy, of course, if you haven't found out, Remus and Shane got a little bit of a tiff on the 1290 round.
They have
a
beef.
That's why Remus is currently trying to buy a Nadi jersey.
Do you think when Shane Nadi was in Ottawa, they had a free Bruce Gardner tweet?
That's good.
Bruce Gardner number 25. This week. Sergei Kostitsyn, a lot was made about his just completely giving up on a play against the Oilers, which led to a 2-on-1 goal. Barry Trotz was furious. Sergei Kostitsyn, his reputation has preceded him, his brother as well. He's making $3 million this year, $3 million next year on Nashville. Do you see him playing past next year's trade deadline? So over under 330, approximately 330 more days in a Nashville Predators jersey.
Under. I don't think he plays in Nashville next year. What he did was ridiculous. 4 years ago when we first started the show, we were talking about Sergei Kostitsyn and Andre Kostitsyn when they were both in Montreal and the reputation they developed with their partying and all that. As you guys know, I like to party, but there's a certain level of partying, and they were doing a little bit too much of it, and their attitude has not changed in 4 years. Andre Kostitsyn's obviously in Russia now, but Sergei Kostitsyn, I mean, is a lazy hockey player who has a ton of offensive skill, and he's never put it all together. And, you know, I don't think that David Poile, Barry Trotz are going to put up with it anymore.
Yeah, I would have to say under as well. It seems like that that kind of exemplified the attitude problems. I mean, how he gave up on that play was shocking. I mean, when you watched it live, or if you watched it on the replay, you're just sitting there going, like,
Dave, if you're in the Nashville Predators dressing room after that game, how nobody's talking to him after the game. You just totally gave up on your teammates.
I'm not sure if it's even worse than that is, you know, nobody's talking to him. And you could see the bench and nobody was talking to him. But I don't know what happened in that dressing room. There was a time when, you know, I don't know how many years ago that was now, 7 years ago, where if you watched the Manitoba Moose, Hamilton, which is the Habs farm team, had both Kostitsyns and Grabowski, Mikhail Grabowski on there. And lots of people had high expectations for them, and look what happened.
Over under.
speaking of Grabowski, I mean, he's been the best, I think, of those three players. A lot has been made about his offensive zone starts. Elliot Friedman mentioned it on Hockey in Canada this past week as one of the reasons he hasn't performed offensively as people expected. And just to simplify, zone starts. All it means is that he's taken... It means starting the play in the offensive zone, meaning the puck is dropped in the offensive zone, and he is taking that draw. Whereas now he's taking a very insignificant, well, not insignificant, but he's only 36% of his of faceoffs that he's part of are happening in the offensive zone, and the remainder happening in the defensive zone, and not including neutral zone faceoffs. So what that simply means is he's starting more so in the defensive zone than offensive zone, and many are pointing to that as a reason why his offensive production hasn't been what it was in previous seasons. 30.1% of the time he's starting in the offensive zone. Do you guys think that goes up or down, over or under?
I'm gonna go under because I think that unless he can do something. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, if he does something to get out of Randy Carlyle's doghouse, then perhaps and gain that trust back, then maybe it'll go over. But for right now, clearly there's an indication that there's a problem. Randy Carlyle has a problem with him. And so I'm going to go under.
Not using him for the shootout also was a huge... 10
huge,
shooters, and he didn't
huge.
Use him.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I'm going to go under as well because the Leafs don't have the most mobile defense right now, mm-hmm. especially now that they put Mike Komisarek on waivers. Well, no, just kidding.
That's more mobile.
I'm joking here. That was an unfortunate shot at Mike Komisarek. It's unfortunate he hasn't been able to crack the lineup. But I'm going to go under. And, you know, I look at Mikhail Grabowski, and he got the contract. I believe it was 4 years. And... it's not because of the zone starts. Mikhail Grabowski is terrible at faceoffs. He's a center. And if you look at his faceoff percentage, that's not very good. So I think that if you're looking at why Mikhail Grabowski isn't in the lineup, in addition to the fact that he's struggling offensively, he hasn't been very good at faceoffs, as opposed to Tyler Bozak, number one center, who's been very good at faceoffs. But as far as the zone starts, I think it'll go under.
Over under.
Guys, Drew Mindell, of course, who I'm sitting in and hosting for the next four shows, Saturday, next Wednesday, and the following Saturday, he said it to Columbia. Picada Colombiano, chopped specialties, as per Wikipedia, served as a combo platter as a specialty dish. How many of those dishes will Drew eat while he's on his 10-day honeymoon in Colombia?
Lay off me, I'm starving!
Nice
over
drop.
Under
nice
4.5 times.
See, I misread this question. I actually thought it was 4.5 in one sitting, and I was still going to go over. So that I'm definitely going over because if it's a specialty, I'm sure Drew will be eating it.
By the way, I didn't realize that I was sitting beside Chef Gordon Ramsay over here. I'm going to go over. Drew, Drew's never had less than five anything in one sitting.
Oh gosh.
Keep your eye on.
We end the show, of course, with Keep Your Eye On, something that fans can take a look at and, you know, watch out for over the next few days until Saturday's show or, of course, until next Wednesday's show. David, let's start with you.
Well, I think you have to keep your eyes on the playoff race and the trade deadline in 2 weeks, as you alluded to earlier. I mean, we've got teams within 10 points of each other from 6th to 13th in the East and 3rd to 14th in the West. Wow. So, I mean, there's really not a lot of, you know, separation between those teams. So the trade deadline really, I mean, especially in the next, like we say with the Winnipeg Jets, if you can beat the Capitals both games, if you can beat Tampa, you really can step on the throats of these teams and really elevate yourself, and then we could see these teams become traders.
Ezzy.
For the first 5 weeks of the show, I've picked players, and a lot of them have been prospects, but I'm actually going to pick a team and a position. And I mentioned this a couple weeks ago. Tampa Bay Lightning goaltending situation, we're seeing it tonight against the Toronto Maple Leafs. Keep an eye on that. I think if there's one team in the Southeast Division that can turn things around, and I'd put the Panthers and the Capitals in there, I think the Lightning can turn around, but the goaltending they're getting is just inexcusable. And I wouldn't be surprised if Steve Yzerman makes a move to address that.
And Vinny LeCavalier now out apparently for approximately 3 to 4 weeks. That could be the season if they continue to play like they are against the Leafs tonight. My keep an eye on this week is on teams that fire their GMs. Toronto, Columbus. Think about the way these teams have played after their GMs have been fired. If only they had played that way before their GMs were fired, maybe those GMs would still have a job. It's interesting. I find that really interesting, the way those two teams have relative success based, you know, as compared to the play of those teams when Brian Burke and Scott Allison were sitting in those chairs and not scouting for Anaheim and Edmonton respectively. That does it, guys. 2 hours already down.
Where did the time go?
I'd like to thank our guests, Dan Wood, radio color commentator for the Anaheim Ducks. Jim Fox, television color commentator. You got to make sure those are right. For Fox Sports West, of course, with Bob Miller on Kings broadcasts. The late game is as good as you're going to get for that. We're here on Saturday, noon start, Legal Curve Hockey Show, noon to 3 this week. And, of course, this foursome is going to be on for the next 3 shows. One down, 3 more to go, while I fill in for Drew Mandel. For David Manuk of IllegalCurve.com, for Ezra Ginsberg, and for Michael Remus, I'm Richard Pollock. We'll see you Saturday at noon.
You've been listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve. Join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for your midweek NHL update. And join Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg Saturdays for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things NHL. TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.